Okay, welcome everyone. This is Death Among Friends. Crime gets personal. I am Mo Walsh. I am the current chapter president of the Mystery Writers of America New England. And these four authors are also members of our chapter. And we're going to start out with a talk about, you know, when death really gets up close and is more than just your job. Briefly, I will say that the Mystery Writers of America is open to anyone who enjoys mysteries. You do not have to have written a mystery. You do not have to be writing a mystery, want to write a mystery. You don't even have to read mysteries. If you get all your mysteries from PBS, that's fine. If you just enjoy hanging around with people who love mysteries, we would love to have you. And you can check out how to go about doing that by asking us after the panel, going to our booth, which faces the library, or you will have a little sheet on your chairs eventually. And we are at mwane.org. So with that said, I would like to introduce our authors for today's panel. Directly to my right is Chris Knopf. He is the author of I forget how many books, but he has written several different series, but we're going to talk a little bit today about a standalone that he has recently written called You're Dead. And to Chris's right is Brendan Nebois. Brendan also has written more books than I can remember right now, several series, he is currently writing in conjunction with James Patterson. One of the reasons James Patterson is so successful is because he picks really good writers to pair up with. And the book that we're going to talk about today is, oh, please tell me it's got death in it, and I forgot.
No, The Corn Walls.
Oh, it's sorry, The Corn Walls Are Gone. The other one had death. The Corn Walls Are Gone. And to next in line is Elizabeth Elo. She has two books that are just fabulous. The first book you may have read, North of Boston, and this book is called Finding Katerina M. And she'll be talking a little bit about her adventures in research for that book particularly. And also speaking of research, we have Frances McNamara at the end. Frances writes historical mysteries set usually in Chicago, but she strays to Cape Cod, Woods Hole particularly, and a few other places with her sleuth, Emily Cabot, who lives around the turn of the century. And she's going to talk a little bit about Death at Selig Studios. While her characters main characters are fictional, they tend to bump into a lot of real historical figures. So we're going to talk about that today. So with that said, I'm going to start off with you, Chris, and ask you, you have Sam Aquilo, who is...
Aquilo,
okay. Sam Aquilo, who is, you see the name written, you're not quite sure how it's pronounced. But he's a real tough guy.
Yep.
Dr. Waters, and that's really all we know his name, he just goes by Waters or Dr. Waters, is a very different kind of guy. He is a corporate psychologist, and there are probably about three people in the room who know what that person does. So how do these two very different characters handle an investigation when it really involves somebody very close to them?
Well, interestingly, the book that came out about 5 months after You're Dead was a Sam Aquilo book called Deep Dive. So that's actually my latest book. You're Dead came out in January or December, Christmas. But so they both had this, they were confronted with the same kind of problem, because in Deep Dive, it opens with a guy getting heaved out of a window. And the principal suspect ends up being Sam's best friend. So he has a very close emotional connection to this guy. Really, they're very, very close. In thinking about this program, and in You're Dead, the murder victim was Waters' boss, who really was his mentor and patron. And Waters is on the autistic spectrum, so he doesn't make relationships very easily. So he was very devoted to this man. So again, they're emotional connections. And honestly, I come out of advertising, and I heard a creative director one time say, objectivity is worth 60 IQ points. And I think that's really true. The less you know about certain situations, the easier it is for you to see what's going on. So consultants and lawyers and accountants and agency people can walk into a company and seem like they're really smart. And it's only because we're not all in the hurly-burly of what's going on, so we can have a much more objectivity. Same thing applies to solving mysteries. If you're a cop, homicide cop, you're coming in, and to you, there's just a dead body, and it's a bunch of suspects, and you can sort it out. But when your heart is somehow connected to the people who are involved, it makes you a little dumb. So these guys, Sam and Waters, are both very smart people and very capable. And Sam has had a lot of experience solving murders, but a lot of that stuff can get in the way because you're emotionally involved now. So that's my headline on this whole concept.
Okay. Brendan.
Yes.
Your protagonist would seem to be the best prepared of all the characters that we're talking about to handle a really challenging situation. She's a captain in the U.S. Army. She's just been overseas. She's returning. And yet she's faced with probably the toughest problem of all, and that is...
Well, the very first beginning of the book, her name is Amy Cornwall. She's in the Intelligence Command stationed at Fort Belvoir in Virginia. She's been to Iraq, she's been to Afghanistan. She's one of the few women who's accomplished ranger training. And she comes home to find her husband and 10-year-old daughter are missing. And there is a note on a table that says, "We have your husband, we have your daughter. You have 48 hours to do what we tell you to do or they're dead." And then a burner cell phone rings and then it really gets exciting. And what the point is in here, she's a tough woman. She's been under fire. She's been successful in a very still male-dominated role. But she's in the military. She has extensive training. And she's trained in intelligence to look at certain facts and patterns and try to decipher what's going on. That's her job. But here it comes right personal. Her family has gone there at risk, and she needs to do what she can to rescue them. As she said somewhere, she's not a tiger mom, she's a velociraptor mom, you know, the dinosaur.
Velociraptor.
That's the deal. The problem that arises, too, is that she is accused of killing someone in Afghanistan. So there's a person from the U.S. Army's Criminal Investigation Command who's also chasing her while she's seeking where her family is at. So a lot of complexities, a lot of plot twists, a lot of action.
Okay. I'm going to skip over Elizabeth for a second. Francis, I want to ask you, because you have what is called the amateur sleuth, although Emily has been involved in many situations before this, she actually has a police mentor of sorts. But her situation involves one of her very closest relatives, her brother.
Right.
But their relationship is not exactly... So how does this affect a relationship that's already not as smooth as you'd like?
My historical mysteries, Emily Cabot mysteries, are set in the 1890s to early 1900s, mainly in Chicago. She's from Boston. She goes there to be do research as a graduate student at the University of Chicago when it first opens. And she has a mentor who's a police detective. He's fictional, but he's based roughly on Clifton Wooldridge, who was a real character, police detective at the time, who was against graft and was interested in academic studies of criminology. So she works with him through the seven books. And but she is an amateur compared to a police detective or something, so you always have to... Why would she be involved in a particular murder? So this is her brother, the most recent one set in 1909 when there were two silent film studios in Chicago, and she gets a call saying that her brother was found over standing over a body on one of the sets of the Selig studios. And as it turns out here, it's an ongoing series. He appears in some of the earlier books, and in the fourth book, which was set in Woods Hole, he actually married her best friend, Clara. So it's her brother, and he seems, her best friend, Clara, who's married and they have children, there seems to be something going on there that the wife doesn't know about. So she's drawn into this completely in trying to find out what her brother is up to, whether he really is involved in this murder, and what's going on with his marriage to her best friend. So that gives me an excuse with it gives her higher things to worry about. It makes it a stronger story to have that kind of a connection.
Okay. The reason I skipped over Elizabeth is because your situation or your character's situation is a little different. Hers involves family that she didn't know she had. Mm-hmm. So could you tell us a little bit about finding Katerita M?
Yes. So I'm also doing an amateur sleuth. And like Frances, there's a big problem of how do you get a normal person involved in terrible, dramatic events, in my case, in Russia. And so one of the ways to do that, of course, is through what motivates people more than anything, and that is family relationships. So my character, Dr. Natalie March, is a physician in Washington, D.C., and she, a young woman comes into her office. Natalie thinks she's a patient, but it turns out that the woman says, no, actually, I'm your cousin, and our grandmother, who you thought had perished in the gulag, actually escaped and is living in a small village in Siberia. So this is, of course, interesting to Natalie. Meanwhile, Natalie's mother, who's in a rehab home, has never known that her mother survived the gulag. So her mother's really motivated to say to Natalie, please go and find this woman. This is my mother. She can't go because she's incapacitated. So that's how Natalie ends up journeying to Russia. And there's a whole family that really, what is motivating her finally is she's reconstituting a family that was just scattered by history and politics and tragedy. And she has no idea what she's getting into. It's much murkier and much more dangerous than she ever anticipated. But that's her motivation.
Okay. One of the things with all of your books is there's a lot of action, and yet each of your main characters is dealing with emotions that sometimes paralyze people, grief and fear. How do they manage to, or do they manage to suppress those emotions, or how do they express them while they're going about trying to solve these crimes? So, Brendan, let's start with you this time.
Well, Captain Cornwall is a professional, and she sort of has to keep herself tightly wound and make no mistakes because it's her family that's threatened. And to get to where she's going, and she knows that she's being chased by the federal government, she drives from Virginia to Texas. And along the way, she faces challenges like she gets pulled over for speeding, and her license doesn't match the car she's driving. Another time, she just gets caught up, and there's a clock ticking that makes it go on. So the action sort of keeps her emotions in check, but there's one scene where she stops at a Publix grocery store somewhere in Texas and gets something to eat, and a state trooper stops by, a woman state trooper, and says to her, a woman army officer, ma'am, what's wrong? You look like something's bothering you. And she just bursts into tears. She just breaks for a second, and she just says, someone in my family is not doing well. She doesn't tell her what's going on, but that's the one point that she breaks when another woman, sort of military figure, sort of has sympathy or compassion for her and recognizes there's something going on here. But mostly through the book, she is keeping everything tightly in check, and she will take no prisoners, and she'll do anything to get her family back. So a lot of rules get broken, a lot of laws broken, and maybe there's a body or two along the way. But they were bad men.
There you go.
They deserved it.
Frances, Emily's got, she's got a lot of emotions. She's got the, you know, normal fear anyone would have for a family member, but that, as you mentioned, she's got her best friend, she's got her mentor, and they all play different roles.
And her own children, too, who find out that there's a studio up there, and they go hide in the bushes when Tom Mix is doing a cowboy shoot on the place. And they're also shooting an early version of The Wizard of Oz, which they really did shoot, and her daughter is very interested in that. And her daughter sort of runs away at one point. But one of the real problems is she's dealing with her family, so she's dealing with her brother, she's dealing with her best friend who married her brother, and she finds a bit of information, and the way, what's moving the action is that she works with this police detective, Whitbread, And she goes on interrogations with him, and she has in other books and so forth. But she finds out something she doesn't tell him. And she's very torn about whether or not to tell him this thing until they, because it looks like her brother really did the murders and perhaps was having an affair or something. So she has to make a choice about that, and that becomes an important emotional point for her in the book.
Chris, your character, as you said, is on the autistic spectrum, and he explains it in one part of the book that his brother actually explained it to him, saying, some people see red and green and yellow and blue and orange. You see green and blue. So even though his emotions are different, how are they expressed as he goes through this challenge?
Well, I'm glad you asked it that way, because that really is very important to this particular book. My grandson's on the spectrum, so I'm intimate with some of the, everybody's different, so every expression is different. But it's not just that he sees red and blue, he sees them better than anybody else.
Yeah.
He just can't see the other colors. So, and he tends not to be afraid. It isn't really part of his repertoire to be afraid of anything because it's just not in him to do so. So he's a crack shot because he never chokes. His brain never gets in the way of his ability to concentrate. And so there's very little fear. But the other problem, and he does have a big capacity for love, like my grandson does. It's huge, but it's really hard for them to see it when it's coming the other way. So he has a hard time reading other people's emotions. He doesn't really understand what's coming at him. He has to do it by rote and by experience and so forth. So to me, it makes for a very interesting action character because a lot of the tropes are there where he's also a bodybuilder and he was a wrestler. So he knows he's not like completely in any way easily victimized. By the way, my other guy, Sam, is a boxer. A boxer can kick the ass of a karate guy, a professional boxer, somebody who really knows how to box. But a wrestler can kick the ass of a boxer. As long as they get their hands on him, then that's it, forget it. And in any event, this is really, I don't want to give away too much of the book if you're dead, because these elements are really tangled up in the story and how it's all resolved and so forth. So you have this guy who's like the Terminator. Oh, that was the description of that. Somebody called him something like, I'll try to remember. But he's kind of like the Terminator, but he really isn't. He's got huge vulnerabilities. And he's also makes him, it's a first person, so it makes him, in a way, an unreliable narrator. So that was the other tricky part. How do you have a first person character who you can engage with and feel comfortable with who doesn't have the same emotional palette that the rest of us do? And you can be seeing things going on in the story, and you go, what are you doing that for? But he thinks he's doing the right thing. In any event, I don't know if I answered your question or not.
No, that's great. Now, Elizabeth, your character's emotions are actually even in more turmoil because she's fearing for someone that she really has no clear picture of or experience of.
Right, right. And, the way that I always think of Natalie is that because she's a doctor, her life has been fairly structured. She went to college and medical school, internship, residency. Now she's a practicing physician. She has a very successful practice. She works really hard, but her life is really contained in that world. And all the people that she knows are like her. So when she takes this trip to Russia, and there's everything that comes at her is something that she's never seen before, never experienced before, and she's really thrown back on her heels and finds herself needing to react instinctively to what's happening around her. And it brings out this whole other side of her personality. So I sort of saw it as a growth for her to discover, more of her, animal nature, rather than just her intellectual nature. But at the same time, because she's a doctor and a scientist, she has a lot of the qualities of a professional investigator. She's willing to follow the clues and put her fears behind her because she's a scientist and she wants the answer. So those things are kind of in juxtaposition in the book.
Okay. Well, we all know if you have a mission to make it interesting, you have to have an obstacle, something that's getting in your way. What sorts of obstacles or obstructions do your various sleuths face? Francis?
Well, one of the things is my character goes to Chicago right at the time when social work is coming into, and she works with Jane Addams at Hull House, and she's in the Pullman strike, labor movements, and all these things. She suddenly is thrown into this environment of people making films, and they're making these 15-minute films. They have to turn out so many a week. They're all crazy. I mean, it's like a totally crazy world to her. She doesn't realize that her brother has been a newspaper reporter, and he actually is there because he wants to write scripts. And that wasn't that uncommon. There were other newspaper people who were getting into it. But for her, meeting up with these, there are some real, like a real woman who was an interesting, like Perils of Pauline, they had the adventures of Kathleen. And she did all of her stunt work at that time. And they were very short films. It's interesting that they would be going after this film and then nobody could go home until they had looked at the rushes to make sure they were okay because they had to get them out. And they were under all this pressure. So I think a big conflict for her is going in and trying to figure out what these people are talking about in this totally imaginary world where they're living totally different. And she's dealing usually, you know, with the slums and all of the problems of a modern city, and she can't understand why they care about this stuff.
In fact,
but there is a dead man who's a film censor, by the way.
In fact, what is it that she says to her children that the Nickelodeons in the films are just for?
Oh yeah, for like, the lower classes, you know, because she's at the university and her kids are loving the Nickelodeon films. I mean, and she's like totally ignorant of it.
Yeah, it's just kind of a fad. It'll go away. How about you, Brendan?
Well, my character is racing across from Virginia to Texas, and she cuts herself off from our internet community because she knows she can be tracked. So she has a burner phone with no internet access. And at some time, she needs to get information. So what she does is she flies into a small town, finds out where the nearest public library is, bounces in, uses a public terminal to find out information, and goes on from there. But she knows that the army is after her, but she also knows that there's a clock ticking, 48 hours, and she's either got to get this done or her family is dead. And along the way, she is sort of going through different options as to, she has to go to a small town in Texas, and there's a house there, and someone is being held in the house against his will, and her job is to rescue that person and deliver him to a location in Florida. So she's keying out, how am I going to get to this house? It's just me, I have no backup. And so there's just constant 24/7 pressure that's chasing her. And of course it makes for exciting reading, I hope.
Elizabeth, what kind of obstacles does Katerina face? Aside from the fact that, does she speak any of
no.
the languages in
oh,
the country
really?
That she's traveling to?
Nice.
Yes, actually she does. She does speak Russian because her parents were Russian immigrants and they spoke Russian in her house growing up. And as a doctor, she handles a lot of Russian patients who are in the Washington area. So she does speak it, but she does speak it with an accent, and that automatically means that everyone around her knows that she's American. So it doesn't quite help her that much to fade into the woodwork. But she experiences, you know, all kinds of obstacles. And in fact, I did a lot of research on, you know, Siberia, and I've learned all kinds of interesting things about it. And a lot of them make their way into the book. There's stuff about diamond mining, and there's stuff about unsecured stockpiles of nuclear and chemical weapons, which apparently in certain places in Siberia, you can basically just walk in and take some of this stuff. And just on and on in terms of, the weather, the native people who she eventually finds herself in a village of Saha people, and where I actually went when I was researching the book.
Wow.
And then at another point, she finds herself in a reindeer herder's camp, which I did not visit because they're extremely remote. but I did a lot of talking to people about these reindeer herders and how they live. So,
okay. The obstacles that our Dr. Waters faces mm-hmm. are very different.
Yeah.
Some internal as well as.
Exactly. I've already mentioned a couple because there's the character obstacles with his psychological profile. But also, I mean, it's called You're Dead, because in one of the early chapters, he picks up the phone, and on the other end of the line, somebody says to him, "You're dead." So basically, not only is he knows that he was, you know, for a while there, the cops thought he was the killer, and so he's got people coming at him from every direction. Got the cops suspicious, trying to figure out whether they should prosecute, but he's also got somebody who's trying to kill him, and he was essentially number two in this organization. So then it's like, well, they're going to be knocking us off one at a time. And he's a psychologist. He goes into work every day in a suit. But he's not the kind of guy that people think he is. So the bad guys underestimate him dramatically. Having said that, he's constantly having to look over his shoulder because people are trying to kill him constantly. And he's not an adventurer. He's the guy. So he has to figure out, well, how do I do this? How do I stay alive long enough to track down who's actually at the heart of all this thing, and all these different players, and trying to fit. And that's true of a lot of my book, and I'm sure all these guys' books, that not only do they have to suss out the mystery, not only do they have to use their minds to solve the puzzles, but, you know, they have physical danger coming at them all the time. And think about it, if you had to really worry about somebody trying to kill you, what would you do? You know, how would you go to sleep? Where would you be? How would you walk down the street? You know, how would you drive your car? I mean, at any given time, somebody could get you. These guys they're all paranoid, but for a good reason. So I think those are the principal obstacles. In addition, the more important ones are the ones that are internal and interrelationships with others, but there's external threats as well.
Makes me think, for example, if somebody in my life were threatened in this way, or were a victim, or a suspect, or something like that, what would I do? You know, I'm just a regular kind of person. And even your skilled protagonists are in a very different situation. What skills or experiences do they have to call on in this very different situation from what they're used to? We'll let Elizabeth go first this time.
Well, I guess her medical background, because again, she's a scientist. She's a person who wants to learn and know and follow the evidence and the data wherever it leads. And also, at one point in her adventures, where I won't tell you where she ends up, but she starts working as a doctor in a situation where she's never been before, and that gives her an entree into the lives of people that she meets. So,
Frances,
she's really out of her depth, but she is working with the policeman who is in charge of the investigation. She needing to having had experience with other police investigations and. You know, needing to find out what's going on with her brother, and also being personally involved with some of the people involved, her brother and her sister-in-law, and alibis and that kind of thing. I suppose that helps her with the thing. And she's just stubborn. You have to have a character who's really pretty stubborn to do this.
She's not shy about asking questions.
No, she's not shy at all.
Brendan, how about?
Well, my character, Captain Amy Cornwell, is extraordinarily capable. I mean, she's a woman who was, like I said, is one of the first Ranger graduates, and she served time in Afghanistan and Iraq. The problem quickly arises when she is on duty, she is part of an organization, which is, if you get in trouble, you call for air support or fire support or, you know, someone to back you up. Right now, she's alone. She has her skill set, but she cannot get on a radio and say, I need something, something delivered here, post haste. And also, as part of a group, you know, there's a group dynamic, group decisions, and especially as an intelligence officer, you're gathering information, interpreting it, but it's part of a mass. Here, she's on her own, and the results, if she screws up, is in a bad performance review, it's her husband and daughter dead.
Mm-hmm. I have a good friend who's a book doctor, an editor. She works mostly with people who are coming up and trying to get their manuscripts in good enough shape to take out to the agent and publisher world. But she always tells them that, and these are all mystery thrillers, that your protagonist needs to have a superpower. And now, even if you're an amateur sleuth, which really essentially Sam and Waters are amateur, Sam's got his license now, but that's only because he was going to get thrown in jail for obstruction if he didn't, because that's a real thing. I mean, you know, how does anybody get involved? So his boss, his partner, finally said, you got to get the damn license. But in any event, he has his superpowers that he came up in the world as an engineer. He's a mechanical engineer. He was a problem solver, so he'd go all around the world fixing things like oil refineries, and then he became a head of R&D of a big company. So he's obviously very bright, but his gift is in being able to figure out stuff, figure out puzzles. So he's got that in him. That's part of his DNA. And in the case of Dr. Waters, he's a psychologist. And interestingly, he's on the spectrum, so he had to learn how to read facial language, how to learn body language, how to learn behavior. So in a way, it made him better at it than the average person. So he would know what every one of you is thinking out there. So do I, just so you know. you need to equip, these characters need to be equipped with a wherewithal. And I personally think it's a lot more interesting when they do have an intellectual advantage. Another one of my series is, it starts with Dead Anyway. Which in that case, the protagonist is a market researcher, and I did a lot of market research in my past. And I'll tell you, they're really smart people, and what they can do is figure stuff out. That's what they do, and they have all kinds of different techniques that they can use. They're perfect. They're great interviewers. And one of my clients was identity theft protection, so I called him up and I figured out how to fish. So I can teach any of you how to get off the grid, you know, and how to steal somebody's identity. I really can. And I don't know where I was going with that. Oh, but also, he doesn't have any physical capabilities. I mean, he's actually injured. So he's got some brain damage. So you don't have to be a boxer or a wrestler or a karate expert, I think. He just gets other people to do his dirty work for him.
I was just going to add that a reason that I took this character is that women in the 1890s, if they were strong enough, they had an opportunity to try and do other things. And she comes first to it. They hadn't been able to do graduate work, and she's all excited. She comes to the University of Chicago to be able to do that. And the women who worked at Hull House were out there making changes to laws and things like that that they hadn't been able to do in the past. So she is that type of a woman, and that's a particular strength that she brings with her.
Mm-hmm. What was the most fun you had writing your novels, the ones we're talking about today? Anybody volunteer?
Two things. One was really fun was just doing the research, mm-hmm. Finding out things and talking to former Army Rangers. And the second most fun part was getting the phone call from my co-author saying, this is really good. This is really good. That was really fun.
It's a lot better than when you get that call from your wife or your sister
yeah.
or somebody.
Exactly.
Yeah, this is awful.
I like the research, but on the cover you've got the lion. So one of the most interesting anecdotes was Selig had an arrangement to send a film guy, a cameraman, with Teddy Roosevelt when he went on a safari after he was president. But the Smithsonian was funding it, and they said, no, we're sending our own guy. So Selig couldn't go. So he bought an animal circus, and he built this set, and he had a lookalike, a Teddy Roosevelt lookalike. And he had him shoot a lion, and then they had all the things after it. And then they waited until it came through on the news that Roosevelt had shot a lion, and then they released that film. So this is actually a scene where they're filming it. And the lion gets away. Gets out.
Yes, I think Emily faced one of the greatest dangers in being attacked by a lion in Chicago.
You wouldn't expect.
Elizabeth.
Well, I was joking earlier about how I get enthusiastic about a project and then I jump right into it and I start working on it and then halfway through I say to myself, what on earth am I doing here? Because this is way more than I expected. And that's what happened when I had an idea about, I'll write a book about Russia. I'll set it in Russia. Mm-hmm. And for some reason that was important to me. And I was doing research online and I started to realize that there's no way you can write about a country that you haven't been to. I mean, if you want to write about London, sure, because you kind of can get that. But to write about Yakutsk in Siberia, you can't really do it unless you go. And I thought I was going to have to ditch the whole project, and I was following this blogger, and he does these trips, and we were talking back and forth online, and he said to me, well, why don't you just come, you know? And then he put me with this woman who I would stay at her apartment, she would be a translator, she would show me around, and I looked at the airfares, and I thought, all right, well, I'm just going to go. And then I was there, and then I was in Moscow, and then I was in Yakutsk, and the people that were wonderful, but the best part about it was when we went out to this little village, where the book ends up, and it's a little Saha village, and, you know, I mean, there's outhouses, and there's, you know, the electricity is spotty, and when it rains, the roads turn to mud because it's permafrost, and so the rain can't seep in, and, you know, there's all these things, but the people were so wonderful. And when I went there, my friend and guide said to me, she said, you know, you're probably the first American that these people are going to meet. Hmm. And I thought, well, I better comb my hair, you know. Okay. But, I mean, it was just fun. And we sat around, and we had conversations about everything. And we talked, and I'll tell you something, the very first question they asked me, and this blew my mind, they said, what really happened between Bush and Gore in 2000?
Wow.
That was their question. And you know what I realized afterwards? I realized they want to know if democracy works. That's what it's about. Cool. And and you know how we say United States is the city on a hill, the beacon of democracy, blah, blah, blah. You know, people around the world are watching us. They're watching to see, can we make our society, a free society, work? And they were quizzing me on so many things about our society, and they're really interested in what we do.
How about you, Chris? You didn't get to go to Siberia, which incidentally was not
never been there.
A cold, frozen,
No,
bleak
well, it was
place.
Like summer, so it was beautiful.
Wow. the most fun I have with all my books is writing dialogue. I can't help myself. I like to. Sam Aquilo's a wisecracker, and I wish I was as funny as he is, but he's really funny. He really cracks me up, and I love the stuff that he says. It's really funny, I have a book that I haven't found a home for yet, but I'm working on it. But I had a scene where my protagonist is sitting there. He's a young guy, and he's sitting there with a really good friend of his, who's a little older African American, big strong guy who's an Iraq war veteran and, you know, tough guy, but gentle. Anyway, and they're just sitting there in a car. They're like, it's not a stakeout, but they're just sitting there together in this car talking, and they're confessing about their dirty little guilty pleasures in music. And my guy, who's a white guy, a little younger white guy, says, yo, you know, I really like Grand Funk Railroad. And black guy's like, you like that shit? You know? And then, so what about you? And the black guy goes, well, ABBA. and I swear, my wife sees me doing this. I'm going, I'm writing, and tears are going down my face. I'm laughing so hard. And the black guy goes, yeah, man, but don't tell the other brothers, man. They kill me for certain. Mamma mia.
Yeah.
Okay. We will go to questions in just a couple of minutes. So, very quickly, what are you working on next? And, before you get to that, how does the experience that your sleuths go through in these dealing with these crimes that are so close to them, how do they change the relationship with that significant other, or do they?
Well, I can't say because we'll spoil the ending.
Ah.
So there.
Well, just yes or no, does it change?
Maybe.
We'll let you get away with it.
It changes her. It changes her and her sense of who she is, I think.
It's a definite break in a relationship, and in the next book in the series that I'm working on now, it will still be a break that needs repair.
Okay. I can't reveal too much with your dad because it would spoil some of the plot lines, but the all my characters, I really want them to have a significant others. I have another series that has it's a female protagonist, and I just don't know how to write a book unless there's a partner in life. It just doesn't, you know, it just seems lonely. I got my Sam guy a dog early on, which everybody loves the dog. It's the second favorite character, but it really is, I think it's, I mean, I think humans are enriched by that. And my own relationship with my wife, I'd be kind of worthless without her. So.
So you are working on what right now?
Well, I have this book that I've written and I've edited, and I need to find a home for it. If there is an agent in here, let me talk to me. You know, I got 18 books under my belt. I can write more.
And really funny dialogue.
I think so. You tell me. Read a book, let me know if you think so. But then I'm always got, as I was telling these guys, I always got something in the work. So I just worked out a whole new plot for a whole nother book with a different character. I did it at yoga when the yoga instructor said, clean your mind, wipe your mind out from everything, become completely one. And I thought to myself, okay, what's that next book going to be about? You know,
I decided to be a generous person and continue helping out James Patterson in his career.
He appreciates it.
I'm sure he does, yeah. He sends me ice cream every Christmas.
Have you told him what the book is going to be about yet?
We actually have two coming out next year. One is called Erased, which will be the sequel to The Cornwalls Are Gone. And another one is called The Summer House. They're both standalone thrillers. I also write the Lewis Cole mystery series set in New Hampshire. The 12th book in that is done. And I also have a proposal out to a science fiction publisher for a standalone science fiction novel because I can't not have something to do.
Okay. Elizabeth? Yeah. Well, I think I had to go in the opposite direction. So after Russia and like all these various issues, I'm now writing a book which is about two people in a basement. And that's the book. And and it's like, it's more horrifying than any kind of thing you can find. I mean, it's terrible. It's horrible. I keep saying to myself, who would want to read this? It's just gross. And
two go in, only one comes out.
I'm not saying
maybe.
Frances, you kind of hinted at your.
Yes, I have another book. This series I started in the first four books take place 1893 to 1894, and my editor said to me, "That girl must be exhausted." So after that, I spread them out more. So this, the most recent one was in 1909 with the film studios. I move up to 1917, and it's April of 1917, and the United States is just declaring war on Germany. And Jane Addams actually had been very involved in pacifism, and suddenly everything is anti-German, and you know, you can't call a dachshund, you gotta get rid of dachshunds, and you gotta rename everything Liberty Cabbage.
Sauerkraut, yeah, Liberty
instead
Cabbage.
Of sauerkraut. Right, yeah. So it sort of turns on a dime, because the year before the big song had been, I didn't raise my son to be a soldier, but suddenly we decided to get into it. So that one is with my editor. I've just done a big revision of it, so I expect that to come out next year. And then I'm working on one that I haven't sold that's set in 1919 in Boston when we had the molasses flood, and there's an extra body in the molasses.
Cool.
So with that, we'll open it up to questions. Anybody get your hand up, please? Yes. Yes, there's a microphone available.
You write with James Patterson. Does he write at all, or is he just supporting you?
It's a very intense collaborative effort.
I'm sorry.
A very intense collaborative effort.
Okay.
A lot of give and take. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Do you want to expound on that at all, or
no?
No. Okay. Because partnerships work different ways.
Yeah.
And yours is very back and forth.
It's a joy. Working with them is a joy. It really is.
Everybody says
that. Yeah. Yes.
Hi. I was wondering what tips some of you may have for how you plot out different twists in your books as you're like working out the mystery and the twists and turns and how you want it to come about. Like, do you try to make it so that the reader can follow along, or do, I don't know, just whatever tips or your processes?
Actually, the question is, how do you, when you're plotting, putting in the twists or the that come up with the surprises. I always find it fun to, you start on a path and you throw obstacles, unexpected obstacles. For example, let's say you have a character that needs to get to Boston at 10 a.m. and at 9:58 they're stuck in traffic because a tractor trailer truck overturned. How do you get your character out of that? Or you need to pay a bill and you find out someone sucked all the money out of your account. You take the one tip I always says that you take your character and throw him up, put him up a tree, and you start throwing rocks at him, and you try to figure out how to get your character down and safely. So,
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. It was kind of going your way.
Oh, okay, good. There's two different styles of writing. One that somebody, I just heard it this morning, I can't remember what right. Oh, it's George R.R. Martin said there's architects and there's gardeners. So, but in our world, you always hear pantsers or outliners.
Or plotters.
Or plotters. And, you know, I like the beginning and the end figured out. I learned a long time ago, I need to know at least what I think the end's going to be. But I love the process of wandering around out there. So especially when it comes to twists and red herrings. Somebody once said I had so many red herrings, they're just going to stuff an aquarium. but I really, because as you're going along, then you go, oh, well, everybody's going to think this is what's going to happen, but it's not. Like Brendan says, you just go, choop, you zing it into some other place. And then, of course, then you have to figure out your way out of that. But I find that when Mo asks about what's fun, I mean, I find that a lot of fun to just all of a sudden your character decides to do something that you didn't expect. It puts a nice little twist on the thing, and now you're off to the races doing something else. So I think it's in the writing. You got to write it, I think. My part. Yep.
Another question or another response?
How about another question here?
Okay. Anyone else have a question? Yes.
So often all of you are saying,
yes, what, this is being recorded.
It's as if someone else is writing the book while you're writing the book. and maybe you're just using the phrase, but does it really all of a sudden feel like, I didn't really mean to do this? Or, wow, he did that. I mean, how does that happen?
Well, it goes with you get into a flow and it's sort of like you're in a scene that's going on. So I think most people will think about it a lot ahead of time, but then to keep it fresh right when you're writing it, it's, and then you have to revise too. I would bring that up for the plots and twists and so forth. But other people can answer. But yeah, if you get into a real flow with the thing, then it's your subconscious is bringing it up.
The two most important words sometimes in writing is what if. What if this happens? What if that happens? So if you're writing a scene with your characters, little guy back here is saying, okay, it's going well, but what if this happens? Or what if that happens? What if instead of they end the conversation in pleasantries, a fistfight breaks out? You let the characters sort of do things. You wind them up and see where they take you.
Yeah, Chris had mentioned the plotters and the, we do not call ourselves pantsers. We are organic writers.
Oh, okay.
Gardeners.
That's gardeners.
George R.R. Martin called us gardeners.
I think it's a question of how much you have to rewrite.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't outline it a bit, you're going to wind up rewriting them more.
But you have to do a little bit of both, because if you stick too closely to an outline, it will come out sounding contrived.
Flat.
Yeah.
Because the subconscious is working and is not going to say, that idea you had under, 56A, no, do this instead. And if you don't go with that, it's not going to be as good a book. In the same way, at some point, if you're an organic writer, you have to you have to find and create the structure, or it just becomes a mishmash.
Right.
So it's just a matter of where you start.
You know, what's interesting is sometimes we had a screenwriter who came to, in Chicago, Sisters in Crime, and started to write novels, and it's so much the opposite, because the screenwriters just write the dialogue and there's like nothing. Other people bring in everything else. And so she had to go to being, adding more to what she was writing, whereas people who write novels tend to have to tone it down a little, cut it down so that you've got a plot that's moving along there. You were going to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to say, so often the things that seem new in the book, they're actually embedded in earlier chapters and pages, but you just didn't notice them while you were writing. So, for example, a character will act a certain way, and I'll say, oh, look at that, that's interesting. But I realize it was seeded in a previous chapter, that there was some detail that about her, that now comes back. And that's why when you're writing, you're almost always writing details, but those details are alive and they jump to the next chapter.
Sometimes it does feel like it's writing itself. And, I at this point, this is 17 or 18, I can't remember. And however, I've written a lot more than I published, so a lot of books. Mm-hmm. And after a while, you do get a handle on, you know, the basic three-part play. You kind of know you got a beginning and you got a middle and you got an end. And I never work on the middle, except that I will make up a list of things that can happen. I call it that, things that can happen. And I write them like little treatments, because in the advertising business, we used to write treatments. So as if it had already happened, like the commercial's already being watched, and this is what you're watching. So I'm just comfortable with that format. But like I said, I think it's an awful lot of fun to just be going along. And you'll hear this all the time, that the characters will start talking to you. My wife says that she lives with her husband and about 8 imaginary people who occupy the house with me. But that's, again, it's another joy of the thing, is to just, but it comes from writing. That's the other thing. You got to write all the time. You got to write, and you write, you write, you write. And if you're writing all the time, then you get into this thing where your subconscious can then aid in the process. And it's a lot, it's a real pleasure.
Question, anyone? Yes. So the question is, have any of you considered writing in another genre, and or you considered yourself, I write mysteries and that's what I do?
Well, I have to say my first novel was a literary novel that was a comedy, basically. It was very lighthearted. It was published by Houghton Mifflin in 2006. And when I wrote, when I switched to suspense, they said I had to change my name because there's no way that these two books, anyone would ever think that they were written by the same person. So this name, Elo, is actually a pen name. And the only thing that I can say about that is I'm interested in characters. So my first character, she was just hilarious. What can I say? She had like a very interesting and very funny, you know, life. And that's how she came across, and so I wrote something that was very funny to me. And then the other character, of course, is much darker. So
I started out wanting to be a science fiction writer. I devoured science fiction and fantasy and had scores of short stories rejected until one day a short story was rejected that was kind of mysterious. So I sent it off to a mystery magazine. They bought it.
That'll do it to you.
And they bought the next one and the one after that. And that's when I decided I wanted to be a mystery author. But I went back to my science fiction roots. So I've published 3 science fiction novels, a number of science fiction short stories. I've written fantasy. I've written first-person point of view women, third-person point of view women. I've written almost every genre, including one short story, a Western. Which I'll never do again.
Yeah, I feel like I can write anything. I've written so many different things. I have a science fiction book, kind of a draft of a book. One of the problems with sci-fi is the world keeps changing. So you really can't keep a sci-fi book in the drawer for too long. I have an intrigue, an espionage book. Same deal. You know, the world keeps switching around me, and every once in a while it gets close. I think, oh, I can reconfigure this thing. But I think these guys hit on the biggest issue is that the publishers don't really want you to do that. So if you're going to get published, do you write under your real name for all your stuff? Or
I sometimes write under Mary Higgins Clark, but I've never tried.
Yeah.
Yes.
Work.
Well, you are George R. R. Martin.
Yeah, I don't know. No, I write under my own name.
Okay, well, good. Well, congratulations, because it's not that easy.
Nope.
They don't really want you to do it. They fight you on it. I'm writing a nonfiction. I'm editing, really, but I'll be doing some writing. But that's funded by grants, so I don't have to worry about publishers pushing back.
But, I always read mysteries, but I did work with an amateur dramatic group to do mysteries for fundraisers for libraries, and I've taken some dramatic courses in Chicago theater courses.
Okay.
But basically, I always read mysteries.
That's what it's like at home all the time.
Yes, question.
Sure.
Men writing women.
Men writing women, yeah.
I did it.
Sure. Go for it. Right.
I don't love it, but so
Chris, you got this.
I could start.
Let me just restate briefly that the question really is what do you do to try to make your female characters as real as your male characters, within the confines of fiction?
Hmm. Well, I was lucky. I have a which really turned into a trilogy, although I might publish more if they want me to, with a female protagonist. But it was a spin-off from my original series, so she was the most popular character, except for the dog, in that original series. So I kind of already had her. I had her personality, I had her style. She had enough of a tomboy quality to her, which helped. I never had anybody ever tell me that I had it wrong. Now, you may feel that way. I invite you to buy the books. You got to buy all three.
Yes.
Get to the end before you're really qualified to say. But I sold the book to St. Martin's. Was a female editor there is the one who bought the book. And she said it's how I described my character as getting when she was getting out of her bra. That's all I'm going to say. But apparently, she found it to be very authentic. And in the book, I mean, somewhere I wrote that I'm not a woman myself, but I know a few pretty well. I live with one, by the way. I don't know. And that if you live with a woman, you're going to get to know a lot of stuff. And if you're and I have a lot of close female friends, and by the way, also the female editors. Both editors, I had one in Canada and one down here, they both were female, and I guess I have to admit that there's a few places they said, Chris, no, no woman would ever do that. I go, it's cool.
My first reader is my wife. She's one of the smartest women I know. She has an MBA in business from MIT, and she reads all my stuff, and she tells me when I get it right and when I don't get it right. And most editors are women, and they will not hesitate to tell you when you don't get it right or if you do get it right, so...
You got a lot of critics too. You get eaten alive maybe some guys deserve it, but you really better get it right on the way out.
Yeah. So just to be fair and very briefly, because we have to wind up, do you have any trouble writing men lately?
Oh, good question.
The series
I have is in first person and it's a woman talking. The series I'm working on is third person, but it follows the medical examiner at that time, who is quite a character. And then a woman character at that time. So I guess I'll find out more from that.
I've had this conversation with people. You know, one of the most important people that I've ever read is Carolyn Keene, who wrote Nancy Drew. And when I was young, I read all the Nancy Drews. And it meant a lot to me to have a female character like that. And I guess I'm just committed to writing women who are doing cool stuff.
Okay, well, thank you all very much for coming. We appreciate it.